University of Pittsburgh, and was a 2013-2014 Fulbright Fellow in Romania. He holds MAs in Romanian Studies and History from, respectively, Indiana University and the University of Vermont. His MA thesis in history at UVM compared the rise of political Islam in Iran during the 1960s and 1970s with the politicization of Orthodox Christianity in Romania during the 1920s and 1930s.
Thank you very much for the introduction, and thank you all for coming out this morning and attending this section of the sermon. I'm very grateful to Herbert for the invitation to be here, and I'm heartened to see people here who are interested in learning a little bit about Islam that in a way that transcends the primary mechanism through which most people learn about it, which is through mainstream media and news. Which in and of itself isn't bad per se, but I think what we may all be able to agree on is that the news is notorious for, if it bleeds, it leads, and taking a somewhat sensationalistic approach to subject matters in order to grab and hold people's attention so that they can then sell advertising time. So the problem there becomes that for the vast majority of people and their understanding of Islam, it is conditioned by their exposure to the faith through the actions of its most radical and extremist elements. And if you were here on Friday night, one of the themes of that talk was that these people do not actually represent the core truth of the faith. And in fact, their interpretations of Islam are dominated and dictated by their own political ambitions and choices that center around a very specific historical context in the late 19th and 20th centuries in predominantly southwestern Asia or the Middle East. So what I was hoping to do today is just to provide a very brief, because I have about 20 minutes, to go over, you know, like an entire world religion with, you know, a millennia and a half of traditions attached to it. Very brief working introduction to what Islam is, what the core features of the faith are, so that if you hear about these things in conversation, you'll know what they are all about, and also to focus on some of what I believe to be common misperceptions about the faith, specifically how it relates to people that believe in other faiths, right? So religious minorities within the Muslim community itself, but also people of other faiths living in secular countries or countries that follow a different, predominantly different religious inclination. So the first thing that I'm going to start with is something that many people, especially found in university classes, find surprising, and that is that the God, Allah, that is worshipped in the Islamic faith is the same God worshipped by both Jews and Christians. That the Islamic faith is in fact part and parcel, wholly integrated into Judeo-Christian theological and scriptural tradition. The faith itself stems to the 7th century, specifically 610 AD or CE, Common Era, in which Muhammad, who was about 40 years old at the time, was a local merchant in central western Arabian Peninsula near the town of Mecca, was told by the Archangel Gabriel to go off and receive God's revelation. And over the next 20 years, between 610 and Muhammad's death in 632 CE, he received a series of revelations through Gabriel from Allah, and these revelations were then recorded into the central holy text of Islam, which is the Quran. You hear this referred to as the Quran. Now, when Muhammad began receiving these revelations, he brought them to his wife's uncle, who was actually a religious scholar who was an expert in Jewish and Christian theology. And it was his approval and reception of the message that Muhammad claimed to have received from Allah that gave this initial interpretation validity, so that people that heard it didn't just immediately assume that this guy was claiming to speak, that was receiving God's message, which, you know, you can imagine yourself, if someone walked up to you today and said, God's telling me to do something, and I have divine right to, you know, I know stuff from God directly, there's reason to be skeptical sometimes. But the major point that I want to bring up here is that because of this connection to Judeo-Christian theology, I mean, the Archangel Gabriel is in both the New and Old Testaments, right? I mean, he's a figure, among many other similarities. Muslims believe in Moses, right? They recognize the validity of Moses. They recognize the existence of Jesus Christ. The major difference is simply they do not believe that God's message ceased with those prophets. Right, that Christ was a prophet, he spoke from God, he was able to share God's wisdom, but that he was not innately divine, he was not the Son of God, and that his message and his teachings were not the final teachings that God was relaying to man, and that the actual final teachings were those that were being revealed to Muhammad himself. So in this way, the best way to understand the Quran is not as something alien and special unto itself, although it is bounded, and it's very long and complicated, but rather as a continuation of the Old and New Testaments. A useful analog, for those who know anything about this, although it's very different in many ways, is to think about something like the Book of Mormon, right, which is another addenda to the New Testament. And not think about the Quran as, we would not, you know, as think of it as completely alien and existing on its own, right? So Muslim theologians, Muslim clergy members do, in fact, are expected to know about the teachings and beliefs contained in both the Old and New Testaments, as well as in the Quran itself. That is integral to the faith. It's just dependent on their interpretation of it. One of the major differences, though, that separates Islam from both Judaism and Christianity is that its holy texts don't stop there. The second major set of holy texts in Islam is something called the Hadith. And Hadith is an Arabic word, it means reports or accounts. And basically what this means is that it recognizes the Hadith are stories, parables, lessons, and teachings directly connected to Muhammad and Muhammad's life itself. So the reason for this is that, unlike in Christianity, where you had, you know, the founding figure of the religion being persecuted and kind of, you know, put on the margins of society by the existing powers of the time, Muhammad and his community were actually able to become the dominant political structure of their time. They took over, they were invited into first towns and then won people through conversion. So Muhammad himself was able to render judgment. He was receiving God's will, and so people around him recorded his response to court cases, right? When we're talking about the children's story, right? So how would Muhammad have, you know, adjudicated disputes in the market, right? Or how did Muhammad adjudicate disputes between a wife and a husband? What were Muhammad's thoughts about how women should be, how should comport themselves? And the Hadith, as well as the Quran, thus form a guideline of teachings for Muslims in the Muslim faith as to how human society writ large should be organized if you are according to Allah and rightly guided behavior, right? So behavior that's informed by God's revelations to Muhammad and the teachings Muhammad received from the divine source. And the, you know, so that's a very, if you're wondering where in Islam these indications for, or the idea that women have to dress a certain way, behave a certain way, or that, you know, that commerce needs to be moderated in a specific way, those come from this collection of teachings, both that Muhammad relayed from God, but also about his own life as a human being. And it's important to note here that Muslims don't worship Muhammad himself. They respect his teachings, right? So they view him as a man. There's nothing divine about Muhammad. So when they say, blessed be the name of the prophet, they don't mean that the prophet Muhammad was himself connected to God in the way that, say, Christians believe of Christ, but merely that he was an arbiter of behavior, because he had the greatest knowledge of God's will, because he was the direct conduit. But the problem here is that these stories, the Hadith, are largely anecdotes. So in other words, they're just stories and accounts. And there are over 6,000 of them. So you can imagine that in a when you have that many hadith relating to the life of a prophet and their anecdotes, and remember, these are from the 7th century, they didn't exactly have recording software, right? They're not videotaping, on their cell phones what Muhammad is saying and doing. So this required the Muslim community to develop a way to judge the validity and the legitimacy of the hadith. And they did that the best way they could. They came up with a system called Isnad, which means the chain. And functionally, it's genealogy. They try to track how far back, someone says, well, you know, my uncle talked to Muhammad, and he said that it was totally okay to jaywalk, or whatever, right? And that's not a crime. Muhammad said it was cool. Well, then, so people that know, I'm not trying to be disrespectful, but people that knew, okay, well, who was your uncle? When did he live? Where was this? When did the conversation take place? Was there anybody else there? How far back can we go? How close to Muhammad can we actually get in order to judge the validity of this teaching? So they did the best they could. But there are still 6,000 legitimate hadith that come from this very imperfect mechanism for relaying their truth. And as you imagine, that means there's a lot of contradiction in the faith itself, and in these supposed norms for how life is supposed to be guided, right? There's nothing about Islam that is monolithic, right? Everybody believes the same 20 things. But rather that these hadith need to be interpreted and applied at different times and different places by people with a maximal amount of familiarity with them and their legitimacy. And the imposition of those norms by the Islamic clergy or the ulama is what we collectively call Sharia, the path. And Sharia law is nothing more than governing society in accordance with the collective interpretation of the Hadith and Quran as far as they regard human behavior. So the real power in the faith as to the application of Sharia law lies in the clergy and in human beings. There's nothing about the faith itself that mandates certain behavior. You'll find on certain subjects, 85% of the hadith say one thing, 15% say another. Right? Well, it's up to whoever's on the ground, whoever is responsible for actually judging the circumstance, to go and pick which hadith fits the circumstance and then the specific event, and then apply that. And this leads to a development in Islam that's very important, and that's the development of a sect of the clergy that do nothing but study Islamic law, study Sharia. How do we generate it? How is it applied? And these people are called, in some places, mujtahid, which is just like legal scholar, but also qadi, and that means a jurist. And that means literally the person on the ground who's going to judge behavior in accordance with Sharia law. Right? So, the idea that I would like to relay that's very important, this is a very complicated subject, is that there are a lot of people responsible for interpreting the hadith. There's no one interpretation. Right now, today, there's 1.6 billion self-identified Muslims on Earth. That's 23% of the population of Earth identify as Muslim. Now, less than 1% of the United States population is Muslim, but then you have countries like Indonesia, where almost the entire population identifies as Muslim. There's 200 million plus people there. Right? So as you know anything about human nature, nobody can agree about anything. Right? If you get enough people in a room, there's going to be conflict. And that's exactly what happened within Islam itself. Within mainstream Islamic teachings, they developed legal schools called madhhab, roughly correspond with geographic area, where these ulama, the clergy members, are expected to interpret and apply the law in accordance with local conditions. I can name them if you want and tell you where they are, but it's not super relevant, in the question section if you want. And it's important to point out that these interpretations differ based on location, but they're respected within the community, right? It's not like there's anybody, at least initially, saying, you guys all have it wrong, we're the only ones talking truth, I disrespect everything you have to say about Islam. Your interpretations are a little different than ours, but you know what? You follow the same basic precepts, you're observant of the faith. Which begs the question, how do you then, if there's all of this interpretation and this complicated network of relaying ideas present in the clergy and in jurisprudence and in the Sharia law itself, how is an everyday Muslim expected to act? Well, as you imagine, just like anywhere else, when Islam first was founded, the vast majority of people were illiterate and poor. And when you are illiterate and poor, it's really hard to spend a lot of time reading 6,000 hadith and a very lengthy and complicated holy text. So the basic principles for being in obedience to Islam are rather straightforward, and these are the five pillars that JP mentioned before, right? So every Muslim is expected to accord with the five basic pillars of observing the faith, and these are, in order of importance, roughly, I'll just give you the Arabic names too. Shahada, which means faith, and that's basically, I acknowledge that there is no God but God, and Muhammad is his prophet. Right? That's it. I agree with that principle. The concept of salat, or prayer, this is engaging in introspection and, you know, overt display of faith, reciting verses from the Quran or Hadith in public 5 times a day, and genuflecting to Mecca, which is the central holy city of both all major branches of Islam. The third concept is zakat, which is almsgiving or charity. All Muslims, based on their income level, are expected to give to the poor and to specifically to religious institutions because they were responsible for safeguarding the conditions for poor people and still are today. There are Islamic aid societies, which are Christian aid societies. And somewhat tied to this is the concept of hajj, which is pilgrimage. All Muslims are enjoined, although not required, to make the pilgrimage to Mecca once in their life. And these concepts kind of go hand in hand. So one of the most famous examples of a Hajj was, have anybody ever heard the name Mansa Musa?
Yeah.
Okay. Mansa Musa, right? He was a West African dynast, a West African ruler. He was a Mansa Musa, his title, who lived in, I think, the 14th century and went on Hajj to Mecca from West Africa, I forget exactly where, some Togo or something like that. And along, he was so incredibly rich due to West African gold mines in his possession that along the journey through the Sahara, across northern Africa, and down to Mecca, he engaged in so much zakat. This is so important to being an observant Muslim. He gave away so much money in gold and jewels that he caused permanent inflation in the economies of the countries he passed through. He caused the currency of Egypt to inflate because he gave away so much gold as part of his giving. So this is integrally connected and important in the faith of Islam. And the final pillar of Islam that all Muslims are expected to engage in is called Shaum, and basically it means fasting. During the month, the Muslim faith was a community, a political entity, as well as a religious entity, at least at first, really up until the 20th century, the collapse of the Ottoman Empire, but it's a history lesson. And as part of being a political as well as religious entity, developed its own calendar, a lunar calendar, and it has its own months and its own system of months, and the ninth month in the calendar is called Ramadan. And that month commemorates, it's the time commemorating every year, the time of year that Muhammad received the revelation from Allah. And during Ramadan, all Muslims are expected to fast from sunup to sundown. They can drink water, but they can't have anything else. And that is one of, those are the five basic pillars of observing the Islamic faith, right? So that's it. There's no injunction to violence. There's no injunction to wage war. You notice I didn't say the word jihad or anything along those lines. That's it. And for average Muslim people, those are what's expected to be in accordance and abeyance with the faith. Other thing important to point out, today, as 1,500 years ago, there are a lot of people that live in Muslim-dominated countries that are not, in fact, Muslims. There are a lot of people on Earth, in fact, 77% of the Earth, who do not identify as Muslims. So how does the faith reconcile them, especially with this idea that the faith provides for a legal system that all people should live under because it comes from Allah? Well, this is an answer that really surprises people. So basically, The scriptures in Islam, Quran and Hadith alike, create the category of the bima, which means protected people. This is in contradistinction to the ummah, which means community of believers. And in the Quran and Hadith, there are exceptions, of course, because there's so much going on in there, but the overwhelming of the number of surah and hadith, the surah is just a verse in the Quran, by the way, enjoin Muslims to not only tolerate, but respect people who follow other faiths. Initially, this was just Jews and Christians, because they made up the majority of the people inside the territory that Muslims first governed. But later, it would be extended to things that have nothing to do with the Judeo-Christian tradition, Jainists, Buddhists, Hindi people, atheists, you name it. All regarded protected status within the community. All members of religious faiths that were not Muslims were allowed to engage in worship as they saw fit. Moreover, they were allowed to govern their own communities. They could have a parallel system of courts, were not expected to abide by Sharia law. They could choose to be judged in a Sharia court, if they so chose to be, but they did not have to be. They were under no pressure to convert to Islam, and in fact, in many cases, they were actively dissuaded from converting to Islam. And that is simply because, back in the 7th century and onward, for the special privilege of being tolerant, they had to pay a tax called jizya, that they paid to the local sovereign to protect their rights, basically. You're probably thinking, and I've heard people say this, well, how is that religiously tolerant? You have to pay a special tax to worship how you see fit. Well, you can't judge it by 20th and 21st century standards, because back in the 7th century, I mean, we were still burning witches in the 18th century, right? Jews are still subject to blood libel today, right? So we're dealing with, you know, this is an incredibly tolerant system and incredibly tolerant concepts in this faith, especially given the context in which it emerged. But that's not to say that Islam and Muslims have not historically engaged in persecution. There have been times where Christians, Jews, and other members of minority faiths have been persecuted. For sure. There are hadith, very few, that say, yeah, wage war against non-believers, persecute non-believers, but the vast majority say the opposite. But unfortunately, and this is what most people also find interesting, the majority of people persecuted by Islam, or by Muslims, are other Muslims. That is the majority of persecution that takes place in Muslim societies historically and still today, and that is of members of other sects within the faith. How many of you have heard the term the Sunni-Shia split? Right. Everybody goes, oh, well, the Shiites in Iran and the Sunni in Iran, but nobody ever takes the time to actually explain what that means. So the last thing I want to touch on very quickly is just what the different sects within Islam are, and to contextualize them for you very quickly. The one that I'm going to really focus on is the split between the Sunni and the Shia. The other major ones that we could talk about and I'm willing to take questions on are Wahhabism, yeah. Sufism, and then the Ibadi faith, the Ibadi variant of Islam. Okay, nobody's heard of Ibadi Islam probably, but I can answer some questions about it. The core of the schism between the Sunni and the Shia is very simple. It's rooted in a succession crisis. So after Muhammad's death, there were four rightly guided or Rashidun caliphs that led the Muslim community. The last one of which was a guy named Ali, who was Muhammad's cousin. For a variety of reasons, he was deposed by a majority of the Muslim community by a guy named Muawiyah, and was then sort of shunted off in society and marginalized. It was a power struggle. And the word Shia itself means partisan. People who were of one political opinion, and at the time, this was people who supported Ali's claim to be the leader of the entire Muslim community. I'm going to do this in 30 seconds. So here's the thing. So basically, what partisans of Ali believed was that both Ali and his descendants, because they were connected by blood to Muhammad himself, were able to understand the teachings of Islam in a way that normal people could not. That there was something mystical about Muhammad and about his descendants that gave them something called ismat, or infallibility. And this infallibility in their interpretation of hadith and interpretation of Quran was rooted in a concept called marifat, which means they had a divine understanding of Allah, right? They were somehow closer to Allah than an average person could be. And this is what allowed Ali and his followers, this concept that grew up around Ali and his son Hussein, meant that a sizable minority of Muslims came to follow them. Even despite vicious persecution that really is commemorated most in the Battle of Karbala in 680, in which the Shiite community, the political dissidents, were massacred, and Ali's son and successor, Hussein, was decapitated, and sent the Shia partisan group into dispersal, where for almost 1,000 years they would be persecuted by the Sunni whenever they were discovered. And what they found was that being dispersed meant it impossible to chart succession from Ali and Hussein onward. There came a point at which there were no further leaders of the community tied to Muhammad that possessed ismat and marifat. And these leaders are collectively known as imams. So Shiism basically believes that these imams are there to guide the community, and they are the only ones able to guide the community, and that the last of them is no longer with us, right? There's a point at which there was no longer someone able to take succession when someone was killed, but they don't believe that the last imam is actually dead. They believe that he's still alive, and he exists in Gebat, which means occultation or occlusion. He's still alive, he just exists outside of time. And that one day he will return to Earth and fully rejoin human society, and that point will bring in, that is, Allah will then usher in an era of peace and prosperity, and that figure is called the Mahdi. Have you ever heard the term Mahdi in Mahdism? The belief that the Imam, the last Imam, will come and usher in basically the end of time. Obviously, some similarities to Christianity there, but you can also see how that is wildly in contradistinction to what the majority of Muslims believe about how Muhammad was not divine, and that all of his teachings were simply a prophet. There's nothing divine about him as an individual. And this is the central reason why many Sunni Muslims actually believe Shia Muslims are not actually Muslim at all, that this is so heretical an idea, that special people have a special understanding of God, and that only a very narrow group of people can understand God's will fully, that this is what leads directly to their persecution. The last thing I'll say and then wrap up, because I have time, is just if you ever hear of divisions, further divisions within Shiism, there's numbers. It's very complicated, very annoying. There are 5-er, 7-er, and 12-er Shia Muslims. All that number refers to is the number of imams from Ali, or from Muhammad himself, that they recognize as being legitimate. Because again, even though Shia Muslims make up only about 15% of the total number of Muslims around the globe, even in numbers that large, nobody can agree on anything. So the majority of Shia Muslims are 12-er, or Ismaili Shia, and they are concentrated predominantly in Iran, but there are other communities in places like Yemen, Syria, Lebanon to a lesser extent, Azerbaijan, and other places that are 5-er or 7-er as well. And you don't need to know any more about the distinctions than that, but that's the core of that. If you ever hear that, that's what that means. So, 20 minutes, I went a little over because, can you blame me? I just wanted to provide a working introduction. We're going to be having new neighbors here. I wanted you to know a little bit about them before they got here. If you have any further questions, please raise your hand. I'd be happy to answer them. Anything you'd like to know.
before we have response time, we'll pause for a moment for reflection.